From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man, we pick up where we ended on our previous broadcast and present more of an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast. Hank is talking with Nancy Piercy, professor of apologetics and scholar in residence at Houston Christian University, and author of The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. Let's now join Hank Hanegraaff and Nancy Piercy in their conversation.
When Christianity came on the scene and said, you need to be faithful in marriage, that was not a huge message for women, but it was revolutionary for men. Men were like shocked. What do you mean? We can't have sex outside of marriage. You find Augustine in the fourth century still admonishing Christian men that they should not have sex with their slaves. So we don't usually hear that. But even in the church, it was a difficult message for men to accept. It took several centuries. So sometimes that kind of historical perspective helps us to recognize Christianity applied the same moral standard to men as to a sexual standard of fidelity in marriage, chastity outside of marriage, to both men and women. And that was shocking at the time. In fact, I even quote a sermon from Augustine where he's addressing the man who's having sex with his slaves. And he's saying, you know, your wife is going to tell you that's wrong. You know, the wife is going to tell you, look, we heard at church that this was wrong and you need to stop. So, yes, it was something that was even difficult for Christians to adopt. Now we take it for granted. We take so much of our Christianity for granted. It's become so endemic to our culture. But that's a big one. It was harder for men than for women. And I think that's what we need to understand. The Christian ethic demands a lot from men. It demands that they, like you said a moment ago, it's responsibility, a level of responsibility that they just don't face in the secular world.
So no small wonder that women were attracted to Christianity.
Good. Yes, that is the conclusion I draw. Exactly. Women were very much drawn to the early church. From the beginning, there were more women than men in the Christian church. One of the church fathers, I think it may have been Augustine, was saying, we have so many young women in the church, we don't have enough young men for them to marry. And even outside critics commented on how, well, they would say it in a disparaging sense, right? Oh, Christianity, you know, this new cult here, it's primarily for women because there were so many women in the church. But today we think being against abortion, for example, is anti-women. At that time, they understood very well that being against abortion was pro-woman, that it showed respect for women in their reproductive capacities. And of course, as I said, many women were killed by abortion as well. The fact that the Christian church stood against adultery and fornication, women loved it because it was saying to them, your husband has to be focused on you. You don't have to share him with prostitutes and courtesans and mistresses and boys. By the way, I have a quote from a Roman poet who admonished Roman women that sex with boys was more pleasurable than sex with their wives. So stop complaining, is what he said, basically. There was even, you know, we have questions that are common in public discourse, like debates. We have debates over immigration, right? Or we have debates over COVID mandates or whatever. They had debates over, is sex with women better than sex with men? Which means a large number of people were debating that, no, sex with men is better. And especially sex with boys. So women, wives were sharing their husbands, not only with other women, but also with men and boys. When the gospel says to them, no, men, you have to put all of your erotic energy, all your love and affection, all your faithfulness on your wife. You have to invest your marriage with that kind of intensity. It had a huge impact on raising the status of women and of marriage.
We have just scratched the surface on aha moments, as I'd like to call them. But part two of the book, How the Secular Script Turned Toxic, I want to read two quotes from that section. It's actually in chapter 4, titled Pioneers and Puritans. A lot of great stuff to cover here. But anyway, the two quotes. Regarding women in business, Donald Trump said, I hate to tell you, men, generally speaking, women are better than you are. Barack Obama, on the other side of the political divide, said to women in politics, you're better than us. I'm absolutely confident that for 2 years, if every nation on earth was run by women, you'd see a significant improvement across the board on just about everything. And I read those statements because they're indicative of a narrative that has been cast out of ignorance, a narrative that has taken, for example, the Puritans, as you point out, and recast them completely in terms of fact and fiction.
Yes, I have to tell you, even teaching at a Christian university, I have had several students say to me, I never heard anything good about the Puritans until I read your book. So I'm up against a huge barrier as I try to help people understand. No, the Puritans actually had a very high view of marriage. If you read their original literature, their letters to one another, for example, are very affectionate and use affectionate language with one another, very loving. They argued that spiritually women are equal. They actually used language like equality. And they said, oh, sure, in human culture and customs, men and women are treated separately. But in what really matters, which is the spiritual world, men and women are equal before God. And this was a new one for me. Did you know that the first law against wife beating passed anywhere that we know of in the world was the Puritans? The Massachusetts Bay Colony, 1641, passed the first law ever against wife beating. It was soon followed by a law against husband beating, and then a law against beating children and servants. But that gives you some clue to where the Puritans were, that they actually did have a very high view of women and the cultural narrative that we've heard. What was interesting about this is that even my secular historians, as you probably know, if you've looked at the endnotes, most of my historians are secular people. And one of them is a very well-known feminist historian. And she was shocked by what she found out about the Puritans. And just to give one example, she said, every treatise on household structure gave wives permission to rebuke the patriarch, you know, to rebuke their husbands if the husbands were sinning. And she was stunned by that, that the Puritans thought, well, certainly women had the spiritual capacity to pass judgment on the husbands when the husbands were sinning. And I gave a couple of quotes to show that she was right about that. But even my secular historians were blown away when they actually read the Puritan literature, the affection and love between husbands and wives among the Puritans.
Yeah, and so back to sort of those narrative statements by Trump and by Obama, opposite sides of the political spectrum, but saying essentially the same thing, it is, in essence, a demeaning of true masculinity.
Yes. So that has deep roots too. We can't really understand a social trend unless we say, where did it start from and how did it develop? And that has very deep roots. You have to go all the way back to the Industrial Revolution. Before that, men worked side by side with their wives and children all day in the family industry, the family farm, the family business. And so the masculine ethos, the cultural expectations for men was very much focused on the caretaking role. You know, they're working with their wives and children all day. So of course they need to be gentle and patient, and they have responsibility for the household. In fact, that was the meaning of the term authority. That was a new one for me, by the way. You talk about your aha moments. My aha moments when I was doing the research, they had a very definite definition of authority. It meant the person in charge of the common good. In other words, I look out for what's good for me, you look out for what's good for you. But who looks out for the good of the whole, whether it's the marriage or the family, the church, the school, the society, whatever? That was what authority was for. The person in authority was not supposed to be looking out for his own interest. In fact, their favorite term was disinterested, meaning he was not to look out for his own interest because his job was to look out for the good of the whole. Where did we lose that? The Industrial Revolution was a key turning point because it took work out of the home. Men, of course, had to follow their work out of the home into factories and offices. And that's when you first start to see the literature change. People began to protest that men were losing that caretaking ethos that they had in the colonial era. That, you know, working as an individual, they were becoming individualistic, becoming ambitious, aggressive, self-interested, look out for number one, make it to the top. And the literature of the day began to protest. You know, they didn't like it. They didn't like what they were saying. But it was the first time that you begin to see the male character described in negative terms. And where do they get the quotes that you just had where, you know, women are better? So this was part of the same development.
Stay right there. We'll be back soon to rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Nancy Piercy. Why can't we hate men? Ask a headline in the Washington Post. A trendy hashtag is Kill All Men. Books are sold titled, I Hate Men, No Good Men, and Are Men Necessary? How did an ideology arise that condemns masculinity as dangerous and destructive? Best-selling author Nancy Piercy takes readers on a fascinating romp through American history to discover how the secular script for masculinity turned toxic and what action we can take to fix it. Be sure to read The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes. To receive your copy, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. A deeper understanding of the Bible's principles and truths will improve the spiritual, moral, and ethical problems facing our nation. Yet the obstacle isn't that the Bible doesn't speak to our greatest needs or answer our deepest questions. It's that the average person lacks the time and tools to extract the answers. That's why Hank Hanegraaff wrote the complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated. This expanded edition addresses over 210 of the top questions he's received as host of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Hank has taken the complex and made it simple and memorable. Receive the revised and updated complete Bible Answer Book as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI. And make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches. 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. That's equip.org.
If you thought the pandemic was scary, it may actually pale in comparison to today's pandementia. We're talking about wokeism and its growing legions of followers who have defiantly and dangerously declared their independence from reality. That's right. For those infected by the woke virus, anytime their ideology encounters reality, ideology wins. To help halt the advance of this deadly social and mental disease, you'll want a copy of the upcoming special edition of the Christian Research Journal. In it, you'll feast on penetrating analyses and criticisms of one of the most dangerous ideologies in modern history, all written to help you grasp just how deranged this tyrannical movement actually is. To receive your copy, visit equip.org, that's equip.org, or call 888-7000-CRI, that's 888-7000-CRI.
The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. Here again are Hank Hanegraaff and his guest, Professor Nancy Piercy, as they continue their conversation.
As the public realm developed, it became also more secular. So as factories and industries developed and financial institutions and universities and, of course, the state, they developed this large public sphere. And people began to say that these large public institutions should be run by scientific principles, by which they meant value-free. Just like today, when people say, don't bring your private values into the public arena. So, where in that case, first, two things happened. First, men became more secular, right? They became more secular before women did, right? Because they were getting that secular education, working in that secular sphere. And they tried sometimes to straddle the fence, right? Their sacred secular split. They would operate by secular principles in the workplace and then come home and act as Christian men again. But that, of course, was untenable. But if values are kicked out of the public realm, where will they be cultivated? In the private realm. And who's responsible then? Well, women, because women were then in the private realm. And this is the first time ever in human history that women began to be seen as morally and spiritually superior, which is what you see in those quotes that you mentioned. Up until the 19th century, men were thought to be morally stronger. All the way back to the ancient Greeks and Romans, it was thought that the insight into right and wrong was a rational insight, and men were thought to be more rational. And so men were thought to be more virtuous, stronger virtually. And by the way, even the word virtue comes from the Latin word for man, V-I-R, means man, as in the word virile. So the word virtue had overtones of masculine strength and honor. So up until the 19th century, there was a sudden switch where for the first time, women were seen as morally superior. And men were supposed to come home from that doggy, competitive, rough and tumble world in the public square and come home and be reformed and refined and renewed by their morally superior wives. And women were said to be the moral guardians of society. And I think that double standard is what you see in those quotes that you mentioned at the beginning of this question, you know, that somehow women are morally superior. If women were in charge, they would run things better. There wouldn't be war and conflict. It comes out of the 19th century when virtue was privatized and therefore seen as a more feminine quality for the first time.
You were talking about the Industrial Revolution, and you know that leads me into another aha moment. And as I mentioned before, there were many of them in the book. But this is really interesting to me. You have a piece in the book on why women really did not want to vote. And I think that is so incredibly insightful. Women didn't want to vote, and there were really good reasons for that, because it took the impetus of the man and directed it wrongly.
Yes, so when I mentioned that the book was attacked by Christian egalitarians, this was one section that they hated and that they attacked me for. But I was using the vote as an illustration of a change in political philosophy. You know, I was really using it just as an illustration. So America started out with a dominant political philosophy with something called classical republicanism, which has nothing to do with Democrats and Republicans. It was adopted from the ancient Greeks and Romans. And what it was is an understanding of social institutions like the family or marriage or church as an organic structure with a common good. In other words, it wasn't just individuals coming together with each with their own idea of what was good, but that there was a common good for the marriage, for the family, for the church, for the school, and so on. And the person in authority, back to that, was the one in charge of the common good, responsible for making sure that the interests of the whole were being met, not just the individuals in it. But what about the interest of the whole? And then roughly after the Revolutionary War, about that time, America began to shift to what was called social contract theory. And social contract theory, there is no common good. Social institutions are pictured as so many individuals coming together because they all have the same common interest. We have marriage, for example, since we're talking about men and women in particular, marriage was no longer seen as an organic unity with a common good, but two individuals just coming together because they shared some common interest. Well, social contract theory implied that there is no higher good pulling us together in a marriage or a family. but merely that we share some common interests. And if we no longer share those interests, well, that's okay. We can break up then. And the example I gave was how this affected the debate over the vote. There were a lot of women who were opposed to the vote. In fact, I had so many people skeptical of this that I found quotes from the leading suffragists, the feminists of their day, like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and others, who said the main opposition to female suffrage is women. So they themselves acknowledged that women were the main opponents of female suffrage. And then I have quotes from those women who were against female suffrage. Why? Their answer was that they did not think of it as men's vote versus women's vote. They thought of it as household vote versus individual vote. Hmm. And they wanted to retain that organic view of society where the household had a common good and that the man was responsible for that common good, as opposed to each one of us relates, you know, individually to the state. As you know, there's nobody between me and the state. It's just me, and the individual has no protective barrier between the individual and the state. And the reason that the anti-suffragists were concerned about that was because it reduced the responsibility that society was placing on men. They saw it as a decrease of male responsibility. If men voted as individuals, as opposed to the head of a household, then he was no longer being held responsible for the common good of the household. So it was letting men off the hook. It was reducing their responsibility. That's how they saw it. Now, of course, eventually women came to support female suffrage, and there were two reasons for that. One was, as soon as there was universal male suffrage, well, then the meaning of the vote had changed. If men who were not head of a household could vote, then obviously the vote no longer meant the good of the household. You know, I represent the good of the household. Now the vote meant an individual man. And if the vote meant an individual, then women quite logically concluded that they'd better represent themselves too as individuals. And the second reason was that women began to portray the vote as a way to protect the family. The Women's Christian Temperance Movement, which was the largest women's movement ever in American history, so we're not talking about something small, began to portray the vote as a way to get women's voice into the public realm. And of course, they thought women were more loving and kind and compassionate and considerate, and it would bring a kinder voice, a kinder, gentler voice into the public arena. And she argued especially that women who had drunken husbands, who were spending their money at bars on alcohol instead of bringing money home to support their wives and children, and then because they were drunk, they were coming home and beating their wives. They said, how do these women have any voice? How do they have any way to protect themselves? And so the Women's Christian Temperance Movement started to portray the vote as an opportunity for women to fight alcoholism. And so it took on overtones of protecting the home. In fact, she called it, the head of the Women's Christian Temperance Union, Frances Willard, she called the vote the home protection ballot. And so that got a lot of women finally in favor of the vote. But I thought it was an interesting debate just because it showed how America shifted from an organic view of society that held men responsible for the common good to an individualistic view of society, which pretty much let men off the hook. It said, no, society is not going to hold you responsible for the common good of your marriage, your family, the church, you know, wherever you hold authority.
You do the most delicious job of turning the tables so often in this debate. I just love it. In terms of letting men off the hook, so you're sort of taming men, you're elevating women, but the turning of the tables is this lets men off the hook. And this became part of the reform movements in general. The novels themselves let men off the hook because it was demonizing men, and therefore men were, well, they were simply let off the hook in terms of their responsibility. This is just part of your personality. This is part of your nature. Therefore, you can't be held responsible for it.
Right. So there was a huge mushrooming of reform movements in the 19th century. You know, we talked about the Industrial Revolution. Men's behavior was growing worse. As I said, society was secularizing, men were not attending church as often, they were not feeling as bound by Christian moral ethic. And so there was a great increase in drinking, gambling, fighting, crime, prostitution. Sometimes a single fact can kind of crystallize it for you. In 1830, Americans drank three times as much as Americans drink today. So there was a reason there was a temperance movement.
We'll have to stop here for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Join us again next time when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with Professor Nancy Piercy. Our firm commitment here at the Christian Research Institute is to defend the faith once for all delivered to the saints and equip believers to become true disciples of Jesus Christ. In appreciation for your vital gift to help strengthen and expand CRI's mind-shaping, life-changing outreaches, Hank would like to send you a copy of The Toxic War on Masculinity, How Christianity Reconciles the Sexes by Nancy Piercy. Call a resource consultant at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or visit our website, equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. You can also write CRI at Post Office Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, zip code 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded by listeners like you. We're on the air because truth matters, life matters more. With over 500,000 copies in print, Hank Hanegraaff's Bible Answer books were born out of his many years of hosting the Bible Answer Man broadcast. He's taken his on-air answers to questions and chiseled them until only the gems emerge. Questions involving biblical interpretation, cults, science, ethics, apparent contradictions, and much more. This remarkable collection of concise answers is now even better. My goal, says Hank, is to take the complex and make it simple and memorable. Receive your copy of the complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, revised and updated, as our thank you for your gift by calling 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support CRI's life-changing outreaches, 888-7000-CRI, or visit equip.org. That's equip.org.